Welcome to Watchmen Talk, your number one source for all things related to HBO's series Watchmen, part of the DC TV Podcasts Network. Today we will be going through The Looking Glass, an episode that offered us some answers and no answers at all, but definitely explored one of our favorite characters on the podcast, Detective Wade, aka Looking Glass himself. With me, as always, are Vanessa, Tony, and the ever-inconquerable Wendy. Who's ready, everybody? Let's do this. This one's going to be a long, because there's some moments in this. There's some comic moments that I think a lot of people who were fans of the book have wanted to see. Me especially. Because you know me and my flag, justice for Squid. I had my justice. It was great.
It was very, very vivid.
Was it good? I'm excited. Oh my gosh. All right. Who wants to start us off on our recap so that we can, because we're going to go in depth, you guys. We're going to go in depth.
Here we go. It's so weird seeing, like, so I usually watch episodes a couple times. I can, like, take notes. I only watch it once because I have a whole new schedule now. But I watched it pretty late. But that was what stuck out to me was the Watchtower. And I was like, what? It's not something that I normally see in, pop culture. I was raised Jehovah's Witness. And so that was kind of a part of my childhood growing up, was, you know, going door to door and, you know, spreading the good word, as we, you know, called it. I'm now, you know, no longer in the faith, but I still, you know, believe in God and everything. But it was just kind of wild to see, like, that, just really weirdly see my favorite characters, you know, thus far, his childhood be my same as my childhood. Obviously he grew up a little bit differently, but it's weird.
Can you walk us through, so just to preface with the show so you guys understand, we meet Wade as a teen / preteen who is about to deliver the doomsday clock is at 1 minute to midnight. The world is about to end. It's about to do that a lot. Is that a part of the, I'm just curious as to like what that was like, not seeing it, but like handing out that kind of word, you know?
Yeah. So it's a big thing, in Jehovah's Witness faith or whatever is, you know, that the end is coming. But we're not, it's not like, you know, the end is nigh. It's more like, you know, the world's going to end eventually, you know, get your life together or whatever. And let's save as many people as we possibly can. So the purpose is really supposed to be like, you know, essentially it's like a lighter, more footwork version of like evangelism, but like sort of, yeah, like kind of just go to door to door and talk to people and try to like get them to, you know, go to a meeting or even just like talk to you. I stopped going when I was younger because people started getting violent. I was pretty young and my mom didn't want me around that, and people just aren't pretty intolerant in general, especially because my, you know, the Kingdom Hall that I went to was mostly Black and Brown people, Latinos, and so people just were, and it was Cleveland too, Cleveland, Ohio. It's interesting because, you know, like the language that the guy uses is something that I've never even heard in any Kingdom Hall I've ever been to. You don't refer to people as whores or anything like that. So I thought it was interesting. Obviously that was back in the 80s, but it's just not that far after I started going, but I don't know. I think I answered your question. Hopefully.
No, you did. Yeah. 100%. It was interesting to me that, you know, cause it was such a pivotal thing. Wendy, my question for you based around this was, as someone who grew up in the 80s, and you've talked about this, but I'm curious, did this bring, because when I was watching it, because I live tweeted the episode, did this bring back any memories for you?
Well, the music in the funhouse did, but I'll tell you, the thing that was great about this scene was how many elements were pulled directly out of the comics. So there's, if you remember, the Gay Women Against Rape, which is GWAR, not to be confused with the band GWAR, the concert poster, we talked about this many episodes ago about how the symbology and the squid-like symbology on the concert poster, that poster is on the wall behind the top knot who he starts talking to.
Mm-hmm.
The top knots, if you look at them, you can, they are like each, I think they're each modeled after a specific top knot in the comic, like down to like the symbols painted on the back of their jackets and the way mm-hmm. they wear their shirts. It was just like a whole bunch of really cool little Easter eggs in the scene.
The Vite method. Did anybody catch that in the comic book?
Yeah. That is a play on the old Charles Atlas, which if you watch Doom Patrol.
Flex Metallo.
Flex Metallo is also a play off of Charles Atlas. But yeah, that was literally like a frame right out of the comic.
It was so wild. So they're going through, he's going through and he plans to deliver, you know, he's 1 minute to midnight. The U.S. is about to launch a nuclear attack against Russia. And he plans to deliver, you know, tries to save as many people as he can. And he meets this top knot, who takes him into the fun house. And, you know, he's obviously he has never had any sort of interaction like this before. And she's flirting with him. And one of the things that I wanted to point out that I really liked, that I feel like only I would pick up on this. Well, no, I think a lot of other people did. But I picked up on how she says, this is such a small thing, but I really appreciate it. She says, you've never had sex with a person before.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember in the 80s of the Watchmen comic, there were quite a few gay couples. If you watch the panels, it was not taboo at all in mm-hmm. that culture. It was very much, you know, more like today, maybe even more so. So I think, you know, at that time, it just wasn't, you know, they were, you know, behind technologically in some ways, ahead technologically in others, and definitely ahead socially in quite a few ways.
So it's great. I mean, because I noticed that and I was like, see, HBO, is it hard to do this with shows like Westworld? I mean, we could make that happen, you know, just insert a person. You go full gender neutral and make it. But anyway, I digress, because he goes full nude. She's getting ready. And it's supposed to be a very, you know, I honestly watched the scene and I thought that she was going to convince him not to be religious. I don't know. I didn't know where it was going. I was like, okay, you know, they're acting this way. Not sure what's happening. Is he going to go with her? Is she his ex-wife? That was the big thing that I thought. Is she his ex-wife? Is this how they met?
Yeah, I thought it was too. And then like halfway through, I was like, nah, this is not.
Yeah, they kind of told you the date and that you had the clock and you're like, I was kind of, my thing was, is that it is that, like, you know, he has sex for the first time and he thinks he caused it. That was what I was like.
That's some good sex right there when you end the world.
But that is something that I think we should talk about maybe a little later in the show, is that does he have some kind of latent psychic ability? Is that what his ability to tell if you're lying is all about?
I was wondering.
That's what I was thinking too.
I was wondering if he, if the squid, like, either awakened it or gave him those abilities.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, like, the what that what you just said that made me, like, the squid awakening the abilities, that made me think of, I know CW had their own version, but it made me think of the DC Comics version, Invasion, where, like, mm-hmm. I forgot what those aliens called. Wendy's gonna know.
Dominators.
Yeah, when those, like, you, when the aliens, they come to Earth and they, like, awaken the metagene in, like, the populace. So that's what it made me think of. Like, maybe it's like it definitely could be that kind of event where something happens and then the people who survive are the ones who have superpowers.
I was just thinking that, like, the psychic blast, maybe if you were psychic, you were less. It was less of a or it was either that or maybe it did trigger. I don't know, because I feel like there were some other things in here that led me to believe that other actual, you know, first gen survivors might have had some psychic ability as well.
I think that I like the idea, because it is a very common comic book trope, because, you know, you guys are mentioning the denominators, and then in dominators.
That's dominators.
Amazing. Math based villain.
Demonstrating my DC Comics ignorance. This is why I'm really glad I have these three with me. Because I was going to say, that's exactly what happens in Marvel with the Inhumans and the Terrigen Mists. Now, I know they were going to do a TV show a while back, but the TV show did not happen. And we regret
it did
TV
for a season.
No, I'm sorry. It did not
happen. Let's say it didn't happen.
La, 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 it didn't happen.
I saw it on Disney Plus. It happened. Confront your demons. Anyway.
No, oh, the premise of the Inhumans is that there's this Terrigen Mist that the aliens keep dropping, and when you go into the Terrigen Mist, you come out with superhuman abilities,
or you die.
Sometimes the thing with these mists, though, that really gets me, and that I think kind of sort of applies to Wade a little bit, is that when you go into the mist, you often come out with like weird physical mutations. Like there's this one cop who comes out, and like he's got cyclops eyes, but they don't burn people. There's not like constant lasers going. They're just like glowing white eyes. And so it's like you can't live in society if you have this thing with you. And it really freaked me out because it's like you could be like a dad or like a cop or something, or like a store clerk, or you could be old and you could be going through and suddenly you're in the Terrigen Mist, and then you come out and you look like a bug or something like that. And that really messed with my head. But Wade almost has the same sort of experience, because when he leaves the Looking Glass room and all the glass is shattered, very symbolic moment, he walks down the steps and he sees everybody is dead. And I...
Except for a few. There were a few.
There's a couple people there where, they were walking around helping people up. And
in New York, too, there were a few that survived. Mm-hmm. They just had different brains.
Really? Okay. Okay, I didn't catch that, admittedly. So maybe you're right, Wendy, that it, like, maybe it did waken latent psychic abilities, because Wade is just, he's super out of it, and he's super like, you know, what happened? How did everybody feel, though? Because they pan out, and we see New York, and we see the squid. I want to know how everybody felt when you saw the squid, man, because
I got chills. I actually rewound and watched that scene, like, probably 5 to 6 times, because it was just, the actual comic panel was just slapped me in the face. Like, I was so cool. Like, oh my God. And gross.
One of the things I want to point out before we leave the scene as we're panning away is that you do get a full shot of the Ferris wheel, which is another circle / eye imagery similar to other stuff that we will talk about as we get through to the later part of the episode.
Oh yeah.
So that is a big theme in this. So you know, they went all out on that squid, and it was it was right out of the comic but real. Mm-hmm. It was what the movie could have been.
That's what we had. We could have had that. We could have had it all.
I think from this he gets the idea that mirrors will protect him. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that is anything real or if it's just like they didn't know enough, so this company decided, let's sell them something that will make them think they're safe.
I honestly thought that the company was just capitalizing on people who were desperate and afraid. That was my first thought. I was like, this is a whole bunch of bullshit, because unless they know what they're doing, like really, really doing, then like, and you'd have to, I saw that. I
was right, like, okay, but Veidt and probably later True knew that it was all BS, so it probably was originated by them.
I want to say like the the Reflectitine. I almost want to say that's probably like it actually might have shielding abilities, but like that might be like a general thing where like if another squid appeared, was manufactured or whatever, and it attacked, maybe the Reflectitine would like protect a little bit against it, but it is kind of a scam company. I'm sure whoever like runs the company knows, okay, it's not going to happen again.
Or but it might protect it doesn't from, matter. Like, I'm going to, you know, people are scared they'll buy anything. I mean, there's a lot, like half of infomercials is people are scared they'll buy anything.
So, oh yeah.
yeah.
I mean, yeah. Everybody was scared they were going to miss out on Mandalorian, so they bought Disney Plus. Oh, I went there.
I stayed strong. I didn't get it.
I got it for free.
You're all lucky.
And only watched it because of little yodeling. Okay.
Yes, no, yodeling. Uh-huh. Yodeling was amazing. Yodeling could defeat the squid. I just want that known. And yodeling could defeat Dr. Manhattan.
That's, anybody else? You know, so I don't want to get off on a tangent on it, but that's totally Molly Hayes. Little Yoda is totally Molly Hayes in the comic, even down to the little ears.
Yeah. Anyways, we went to another dimension with Little Yoda because yes, he could beat up Dr. Manhattan and the squid. I will die on that hill. And now
the New York ad that is just totally the most depressing.
Oh my god! It was like, oh my god! It's like 9/11 times 1,000 ads. Like it was just like that. Let's return back to normal. Like it freaks me out. It's like weird and. It was very creepy.
Yeah. Like, oh man, I just love walking in Central Park for hours. Not
here. Right? Like a normal person.
There's no crime because everybody's dead. I'm going to eat some squid. And now what are you doing?
Oh God, that was awful. I said, like, already, like, I can't stand the sight of calamari because I don't like tentacles. And like that, this show is making me not like it even more. So I'm having, anyway.
And he's everybody else is in a suit, and he's there, and he's just telling them, like, he's telling them what the people were actually thinking, which is why I still think that he has, maybe it's not like,
I agree with you.
But I know what
he can read. Yeah, he can read, like, vibes or something, because he caught things, he catches things on people. Like, he doesn't, I've noticed that way back in the first episode, like, or whatever episode he was introduced. Yeah, like, he just has a weirdly innate ability to read people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess specifically on his power, or suspected power, rather. since he uses, like, the terminology he uses feels more scientific than, well, I can just read their mind. So, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it's less of a psychic thing and more of a attention to detail kind of thing. Like,
yeah. True.
Like, well, I mean, like,
if like a savant kind of thing.
So is he, yeah. like, is he like Robert De Niro in Meet the Fockers, where he's like a human lie detector?
I have not.
Although that's
directions.
The whole thing with Robert De Niro's character is that supposedly if you watch people's heart rate and you watch how people look and respond to certain cues, you can train yourself. It's the same thing you do in customer service. If you work in, I mean, and we've all worked in customer service, so you know that when you see the person who has, you know, the set shoulders. Or, you know, who's looking really annoyed and tense, you don't want to necessarily engage them and be like, you know, hi, how can I help you? Or when you see people with certain attitudes, you know, you don't necessarily want to engage them either. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that could go wrong with that, though, yeah. which is why I think that
way back when I was doing another podcast for my work, one of the people we interviewed was a guy from the FBI who that was his job, was to go in and kind of determine whether, you know, watch for cues that someone was lying. And it was what I was doing with teaching people how to use that in a job interview to kind of see is this person really on the level? But yeah, I mean, you can't, I mean, obviously I don't think that's admissible in court, but something like this or something like, you know, whether or not we should pursue a suspect might be usable. And you can see that he might have learned that, you know, that might be something that they're teaching the police now, but that does spoil the idea that he's psychic, which I kind of like.
Yeah, I agree with you. I guess
the only thing that, like, the points towards, well, not the only thing, but, like, a pointer towards, like, actual powers, psychic powers, is that we don't see in the episode any kind of training scene or anything, no mention of how he went from that screaming guy to way, like, there's a gap. So I feel like if it was he trained to cope or something like that, they would have shown it. So maybe it is just innate.
I would agree with that too, because the brain that the guy, the brain that Vite put in the squid, and I still love that squid. I've wanted that image since Zack Snyder denied it to me on the big screen. I love that squid, but they put a real psychic's brain in it.
Yes, so
it's very possible.
That's what I was going to point up. Yeah, I was going to bring that up earlier.
I could bring back one more mundane thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so he believed this girl was going to have sex with him, right? And then she stole his clothes and he was naked and he was then traumatized even more by the psychic blast and everybody, you know, being dead. So it's possible that he's always suspecting people of lying to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that that's why he's focused so much on that skill.
That's very true.
Yeah, I could see that happening as well. I like the idea. It would be, given what we've heard, what we've seen with Angela Avar, and what we've seen with it, I would not be surprised if there are people who are latently begun to develop abilities in this. And I'm going to sign on to that theory. But I did think for a minute that, like, and it would be very interesting with how the episode ends. We're not going to jump there yet, but it would be very interesting to see if this ability is lessened after how the episode ends, because if the episode ends in a good way for him, because I'm concerned. It's going to be very interesting to see if that changes. That's what I'm getting at, to see if it changes.
Well, he couldn't tell all those years that Vite was lying, and I think that's also made him, we could talk about the ending later, but it also maybe made him a little bit doubtful that we don't know what was on the rest of the tape, so we can talk about that too, but maybe he's a little bit doubtful about that as well, because he doesn't know.
So he basically tells he tells these guys that their commercial sucks, and then he leaves, and then...
Lori.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we see him change his car the same way that Angela changed her car. Mm-hmm. So this is his secret identity is working for the ad agency. Yeah, And Lori thinks she has a brilliant idea, but I don't know. I mean, it does seem a little too obvious, but maybe she doesn't think she's dealing with anybody other than, you know, common white supremacists.
Do we still think that, I mean, obviously they're white supremacists. Obviously that they are white supremacists.
Yeah.
They're being used as tools.
They're being used as tools for something bigger.
That doesn't make them good guys.
I'm not hinting. I wasn't suggesting that at all. What I was going to say was, like, is their goal still cleansing something, or is there, like,
Their goal doesn't matter. Their goal. I don't think their goal matters at all. I think
the goal is. I think. Them. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a. Right. They're. Yeah. They're being used as a hammer, as a distraction. Yeah.
I'm sure that. Well, when we get there, I'm sure the thing they're building is related to the other guy's plan. But well, yeah. Let me not skip ahead.
Let's not
skip ahead. There's so much before then. So Lori's idea is that they have to go to every church and maybe they'll find them. But we're not following that story. So she sends everybody out. There's only a few detectives left.
Oh, yeah. Doesn't Angela come up to talk to Wade at that point?
Well, first we get Red Scare eating the lettuce.
Oh, and Panda.
Oh, yeah. That was such a, like, I don't know, like a sitcom, cop sitcom moment. Like, I was like, is this Brooklyn Nine-Nine? Where am I watching? Yeah. Like, that was such a, like, maybe Boyle, why am I blanking on the name? Never mind. Anyway, skip it. But yeah, no, that reminded me a lot of
Peralta.
Boyle and Peralta. Yeah. But no, it reminded me, like, it was straight up ripped out of like a sitcom moment. It was Red Scare just continues to delight me in his, and just his sheer audacity of him.
I love the juxtaposition between these characters who are clearly, not comical, but very, well, no, they are kind of comical. I mean, you wouldn't get a bunch of cops sitting around. Maybe you would, I don't know, given how many people were so excited about the friggin' Punisher logo and being assholes about that. But that's actually another thing we could discuss if they went going into that, because the idea of police officers as symbols, and then it really kind of made them look like clowns, and I liked that a little bit. But it was just, it's always so jarring to have them have those like Brooklyn 99 moments, and they're all in costume. Like, the only one who takes it seriously is Angela and Looking Glass. The rest of them are just kind of like wandering around. One dude's in a rotting panda head.
Panda. So Panda made another appearance, and there were pandas in the brochure. And I'm not saying that's important, but we got to call it out. There were pandas in the Watchtower issue he was handing out, and then this guy has a panda mask.
So I can actually explain that a little bit, like the cover. So a lot of the covers of Watchtowers, especially like, they usually try to, they depict like paradise. So the art like tries to depict like what Earth could be if, like, you know, in paradise or whatever. So like pandas and like, it's like supposed to represent like Garden of Eden, and like, you know, pandas in paradise, I guess. But I thought pandas were the mean, are koalas mean ones, or the pandas the mean ones? Regardless, that's supposed to be what they're supposed to. Yeah,
koalas are nice. Things. Yeah, koalas.
Pandas are nice.
But pandas also have the Rorschach black and white.
Yes, yes. That's also like, I think it's I think it's interesting that it's tying in like a very specifically religious imagery with, yeah, like the, you know, what is now a symbol of white supremacy.
Poor pandas. Yep. They didn't have anything to do with it.
It's like the, what was it? It's the same thing with the racist frog thing those idiots did when they took over.
It was just sad because I remember that being just a normal meme.
Yeah, and then, it was just a normal meme, and then the guys took it over and made it like a hate symbol thing.
Wasn't it PP? Isn't that the name? PP the frog.
Yeah, Pepe. Pepe. I always pronounced it Pepe, like Pepe.
Yeah, I don't know. The Pepe.
Anyway,
I mean, I don't know. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
That's the one thing I'm noticing a lot about the show. Just every episode is warped imagery and warped symbolism. Something that used to mean something is now meaning something else, or may mean something to one person means something completely different to something someone else. Like, all these symbols are, and this is the same thing within the you know, the original series too, like the original graphic novel, like every symbol is something different. They keep repeating them over and over again, like the panda kept popping up. It's a little overwhelming, to be honest. I can't catch them all.
Oh yeah. You mean how many Easter eggs with the freaking perfume and the freaking cereal?
Yes.
And oh man. You know, and right, what's the worst is I want all those products to be real.
So back to that, we have the cactus. You know, I mentioned a couple of times, what is up with the cactus? Why is it? Because the cactus, in one of these shots, the cactus is in the middle of the shot. Mm-hmm. And then Lori's to the left.
Focused,
and the
two
of them are to the right. And I'm like, so on the one hand, I'm like, well, he has a spiky thing between him and Angela because he's trying to keep his distance from people, which makes sense. But you knew, like, they pretty much telegraphed something's up with this cactus. Mm-hmm. So he gets called into the office, and she asks him a bunch of kind of ordinary questions, which makes him uncomfortable, which was the purpose. But he knows it because he's reading her, including taking off the mask, which he doesn't want to do. And I think she knows why he wears the mask, and, you know, she's just trying to antagonize him. And, of course, eventually she reveals why.
So I have a fun thing about the mask. There was a article with the costume designer, and I don't remember. I was scrolling through my Twitter feed, and I found it. And the costume designer was talking about Looking Glass's mask, and apparently you cannot recreate how it looks without CGI. There were there were something like five different ones that they used. That they've been using through filming, but the ones that they always use for the head-on shots have CGI, so they add in the digital mirror effect. So like, even that's not technically real, but I love the way she says so cavalierly, "Oh, I bugged your cactus."
Like, she's just, yeah, we do it.
I know, right?
We love bugs.
So she knows about that he's looking into the pills. I thought Angela was a bit mean to him here, and I'm not sure why. Or maybe it's just perception. I don't know.
I didn't feel it in this scene. I did feel it in the later scene, though.
Yeah, she's just being very. They don't mean to be aggressive.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like that's kind of her too. Like, yeah. It's not weird. It's just kind of.
That's her thing.
Yeah, I think she's just a kind of a gruff person, even with her own husband.
She's not really, they're not really like friendly friends. Like, I think everybody's friendship really kind of revolved around Chief. And now that Chief is dead and Angela knows that Chief was a lot of bullshit, then I think Angela is also less inclined to trust people the same way that Looking Glass is. And I also don't think Looking Glass cares. Like, I would love for him to care.
I don't know. I think we'll wait till we get there. I reread that like 3 times trying to figure out what the heck was he doing. And I we'll talk about it when we get there. But I don't think it's so much of a betrayal as we think it is.
Oh no, I don't. Yeah. I think he's really thinking about it. But we'll get there.
We'll get there. But at any rate, so yeah, I think he does. I mean, he cares about Angela, but I mean, he cares about a lot of people, but he doesn't like to get close.
That's true. Okay, that's fair. But like the suspicion between everybody is kind of mounting, and like, you know, everybody's just kind of sailing through the seas at that. But the episode really focuses on Wade, and now we go through, and after the office, I forgot. Oh,
whole bunch of reveals. So he has a home mask. He has his work mask and his home mask. Remember when we thought he was wearing his mask at home? That is his home mask. He takes it out of his safe in his house. So he takes his off in the like little store your secret identity. Store your cop car. What are we calling that? Storage unit. And then when he comes home, he pulls another one out of the safe. And then he proceeds to open a very Rorschach can of beans.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, it's if you haven't seen the original, there's a classic scene where Dan Driver comes home and in his kitchen is Rorschach with his mask half up eating a can of uncooked beans. So he does this. He eats a can of uncooked beans.
I do think those beans come cooked. It's just not hot.
They're raw beans, but they're cold, like in bean juice in a can. They'd be better hot, but yeah, they're completely safe to eat cold. He's not going to get worms or anything.
Is anybody else? Am I the only person who dislikes beans?
I am not a fan.
I love beans.
I'll eat them like sometimes if they're in other stuff, but it is really a
them off my meal.
I've been desensitized to like red, like black eyed peas and like rice. we had that for like every meal like when I was growing up. So.
Yeah, I don't like certain beans. I'm like okay with if they're like saucy or whatever, because like Puerto Rican food is like rice and beans or whatever. But like if I can have them without, like I hate refried beans. Ugh, gross.
And chili? Do you chili with beans or without beans?
Chili beans. Yeah, chili with beans is obviously like that's hot chili is. I'll eat that, but like I usually it's like very, it's rare.
Yep, and I okay. So and I'll eat chili because Disney serves Walt's chili recipe like everywhere. Because Walt Disney was obsessed with chili, so he serves that fun. This is what you guys signed up for, everybody. You're listening to our podcast. We're gonna talk about beans. but he's eating the beans now. Is this when we get to him watching American Superhero Story? American Hero Story. At that scene. And like this is definitely I really want to meet this universe's version of Ryan K. Murphy, man.
Do you want to talk about Petey's takedown of this?
Yes. Oh my god.
He was so mad. That was like the equivalent of stomping his feet. He's had enough.
So you guys... first one was bad. This one, he was very angry in this new installment of anti-American Hero Story on PDpedia.
You guys are the ones who are actually reading PDpedia, so you guys should explain to the audience, and by the audience I mean me, what happened because I have not.
I'll start and then y'all can pick up. But I think that's actually the only time they confirm that it is American Hero Story. Or if you're just watching the episode, you might be like, oh, well, I guess he's just watching lurid content at home, you know, but Petey, like, okay, he writes his letter saying the show's garbage, and he goes into why this particular episode is garbage, and it's not, like, honestly, a lot of it made sense, like, even just from a, I guess I know what happened because I read the comic, but like the way he talked about, like, oh, well, they dramatized the rape scene and, oh, not rape, sexual assault, which he was very clear that it was sexual assault and not attempted rape or anything like that, which I was like, okay, yeah, like if you're having a TV show, you don't really want to make that a dramatic thing. It's more of a, it's, I mean, it's a factual event, but you don't want to, like, make it, you know, like,
violent, don't put too, yeah,
much, yeah, you don't want to put too much, like, focus on it,
like how everybody read HBO the Riot Act and dragged them rightfully for how they handled it in Game of Thrones. You can't, yeah, let HBO, like, forget that Game of they did that, and they it's a good thing they're learning, because that really pissed me off. But
I'm,
yes,
not sure they're learning, but we'll get there. So there was some interesting things about this that I thought were parallels. If I'm going specifically off the PDPedia article, now there's. So one of the things that I was thinking about Dan and Lori, and especially after last week, and one of the things, I went back and read that last scene where she's like, you know, I want to be the comedian. And in that scene, Dan asks for and is given the Tijuana Bible, which to me means that he, this is the last scene in the Watchmen comic, or one of the last scenes, not the very last one, but Dan and Lori go to see the original Silk Spectre. And he pockets the Tijuana Bible, and she says, you know, oh, you can have it. You know, but then he's obviously fantasizing about Lori's mom, which is kind of then makes it creepier when you think about that. He then asked her if she would be Silk Spectre for his Night Owl, and to which she's like, no, I'm going to be a comedian. But then you have Petey, who regularly attends a one woman show about Silk Spectre's life, like, on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So it just to me means it's like he doesn't see the comedian when he sees Laurie. He sees Silk Spectre in my mind. It's still a fantasy. It's still an objectification, even though he goes on and on about he's very enlightened on all these other topics. But he's definitely objectifying Lori.
I do question. Lori is just, I love
Lori. She takes full advantage of it, but he's a little mini Dan Driver. Slash Lube Man.
Long live Lube Man! Must return. Lube Man. So after, okay, so that's, so for.
Don't skip too far ahead, because, oh, so yeah, so after the movie, the alarm goes off. He doesn't get to finish watching the TV show. The alarm goes off, and it's really frightening. And he tries to shut it off, and he can't shut it off. He ends up destroying it. The symbol on this thing is very much a vertigo, in my opinion, a vertigo symbol. So I think it's about that kind of, it's inducing that kind of panic because of the psychic attack, but it is concentric circles. So he ends up smashing his alarm, which I have done to alarms on occasion. you know, I'm not proud of it, but at 3 o'clock in the morning, sometimes you got to shut an alarm off. So
my detector once went off, and I literally smacked it off the wall. And because I was renting, I had to pay for the damaged smoke detector because it was 3 in the morning. But it was 3 in the morning, and I remember crack, crack, crack. And my landlady runs in, and she goes, "What are you doing?" And I would look down, and I was like, "Oh crap!"
Plug in carbon monoxide detector. The batteries were dying, and. And, like, there was no way, I just couldn't figure it out. I had the batteries out of it, and then it went off even more because there were no batteries in it. And I didn't understand that you had to discharge it in order to get it to shut off. And, like, I had 2 babies, and I thought my ears were going to bleed. It's like I had to take it out. So I can feel for this situation. Although we get to learn a lot about what happens next.
But and we have to, before we move on to that, I want to say that this scene was what kind of convinced me that these extra-dimensional security devices, because that's what they are, EDS, extra-dimensional security devices, and he only says it at the end when he's yelling about, because he calls the company, and he's yelling about how this device doesn't work, and he does admit that he's running these drills far more frequently than the company suggests.
Yeah, it's an addiction.
It's an addiction. He's running these drills far more frequently than the company suggests. So,
I'm going to say that because I have like anxiety and like OCD, and I do want to say that it seems more like a ritual.
Yeah.
It's kind of a, he has to do it to feel comfortable. Compulsive. Kind of thing.
Yep. I was OCD from 9 years old to about 23. And it was, you know, in with the trauma, out with the trauma, but it was, I remember, and it was very much like, you know, you don't even understand. I'm not going to be able to sleep unless I do this.
Yeah.
But I feel for him. I don't think he's crazy. I mean, he's been through a traumatic event and he has to find a way to calm the anxiety. And this is, you know, a lot better than taking whatever drugs. So he does what he has to do. But again, I mean, it's his life. And so his alarm in his house is not working. So he has to then go and sleep in the shelter, which we now understand.
And that shelter, like, you got to wonder how many people have shelters like that.
Yeah.
I understand. Yeah. And he's, but he then sleeps on the couch and stares at the bunk beds. And you got to wonder, is that where he and his ex-wife used to sleep?
Oh man, him and his ex-wife, and when you find out what she does for a living.
Oh no.
God.
We skip one scene is the smiley O's, which I just got to talk about the two Easter eggs and the smiley O's before we move on. The kids, you have to worry about BS with the kids because they're like, this is crap. But the smiley O's are, the smiley O's are, of course, the Watchmen smiley face, but smiling. And I guess they're supposed to be Cheerios. Here, let me see if I can. And then the name of the company that makes the cereal, I'm trying to freeze on that frame there, so I don't remember off the top. But the name of the, does anybody have it? Name of the, all right, let me just press play until it, oh, so hold on, 1, 2, 3.
Well, Wendy's playing this, I want to tell you guys, you know, FYE, the four-year entertainment, they have these like original cereals where they're like Black Panther cereal or Deadpool cereal. I'm just saying, FYE, if you made this cereal real, I don't care how it tastes, I'd buy it.
But it's known for taste, so it's all smiley faces. So the cereal is all smiley faces, and it's by Happy Harry's, and Happy Harry's is the name of the bar that Rorschach goes to beat people up in the kind of the beginnings of Watchmen. I don't think Wendy, that Happy Harry then decided to make cereal. But
Wendy, your skill is, that's your superpower, isn't it? Come clean. That's
a little stupid minutiae here.
That's not stupid. I mean, the level of detail deserves to be appreciated.
Yeah, yeah, that they even thought to do that, is
right?
The more we can catch, the better. So
yeah, because it all explains it.
The next scene, my friends, we had a long talk last week that I think it was very good to prepare us for the terrifying morality that we have to discuss with the next scene.
Oh yeah, forever pet.
The iPet store with so you guys called it forever pet. I didn't catch that it was forever pet. I was calling it the iPet store. Because, you know, you have all these people walking through and it's very futuristic. And the whole point of the iPet store, forever pet, is that you can clone your pets and you can have them live forever.
Well, you can just keep getting a new one. Like, as they wear out, you just get a new one, kind of like Dr. Manhattan did with his first wife. But,
I noticed. I think you're about to say it, but I think I noticed there were only like clones or twins. I'm guessing clones.
Yeah, which is what I'm sitting here saying is that, like, you are now put in the situation where it is important now. So, all right, so first to talk about the clones, the cloning pet industry was in the original Watchmen, and it was an offshoot of Veidt's research. He was able to capitalize on it, but it was, obviously he made Bubastis. He was working with the genetics to try and figure out how to make the squid, and he learned how to clone as part of that. And so, but it wasn't like they didn't really do people. It was just for pets and stuff like that, because of, I think because of the ethical concerns, although he's not ethical on a lot of other things. But the people were concerning, because these are obviously two people who are valid people. But then, and I want to say the next scene where he goes and meets his ex-wife, and you can tell me if I'm totally off on this, but to me it was a mirror of the scene in Watchmen with Manhattan and the comedian in Vietnam, because he knows exactly what she's going to do to that puppy.
Oh yeah.
And he doesn't stop her. So the one time she's monstrous, but he didn't stop her. So what does that say? Mm-hmm. And where is his sensitivity or morality?
What does that say about everybody in the area too? Because yeah. You have to know what's going to happen. So the fact that this has progressed for 30 years and you've had 30 years of people treating what amounts to animals. I mean, I don't know if you guys, I'm sure we all remember Dolly the sheep.
Yeah.
Clone Dolly the sheep. And for a while that was the big thing. And like everybody was like, we cloned a sheep. The world is going to end. The sheep. And now we've progressed so far, and there's positives. There's so many positives, and thankfully we've turned it into a positive direction to have that technology. But now you have the reverse in a society where that's negative. I mean, you can't be stupid. People have to know. Like if you go to the iPet store and even me treating this cavalierly, and I am sorry, readers, I'm trying for a laugh, and I'm probably sucking at it, but you have to know that there's always going to be an iPod at the iPod store, at the iStore that doesn't work. You know?
But they do that to real dogs now. So we're going to start with the fact that this is wrong, and
yes, 100%.
But they do this to dogs nowadays if they can't find a home for them, but I think my worry is that this kind of thing feeds into anti-assisted reproduction, reductive technology fanatics. And I'm not going to go too far into it, because I do think this is meant to be showing a society that's gone wrong in this area. But at the same time, this is what people think happens, in the IVF lab with baby stem cells and stuff like that. So it's like it's kind of feeding into that. Weird. It's another weird phobia, but yes, people do now do that to dogs. But at the same time, it's like cloned people are people. There are much higher ethical standards for cloning or for any kind of ART than they're showing in something like this. I mean, this is kind of cavalier sci-fi, but I guess it's Veidt's company, so.
I do want to mention that on PDpedia there's like a little pamphlet about dealing with anxiety trauma kind of mm-hmm. from the event, and mm-hmm. it does mention that pets are a way to heal. So I'm
but
guessing
he does
that
say
would be
to her.
Because he doesn't think
he's like, what am I going to do with the dog? But I'm like, the irony is you wrote this pamphlet that tells people to get a dog. But yes.
We clearly see like throughout the whole episode that he's not believing what he's selling. So I mean, that's telling these people. But I think it's interesting. They basically created a self-sustaining economy where they created a so-called solution, and then they kept exacerbating it with these squid falls, and it created an actual anxiety / disorder that requires people to have maybe pet literal help pets or whatever they're called. People have them on planes and
emotional
stuff. Emotional support animals. And then you now have an industry that literally capitalized on that. It's like a literal ecosystem capitalizing on people's trauma that they created, that he created. It's wild to see the like map. But his, you know, it just keeps, he keeps capital, you know, not him personally keeps capital, but like he started the industry, which is literally capitalizing on it, which I'm going to, here's where I'm going to go. I'm going to compare it to the companies that exist in our, you know, in the United States of America that were built off the back, you know, built off of slavery and off of the money that came off of slavery and the money that, so it's so fascinating to me that they continue to show examples of this, of how, you know, they created, he created a specific, he traumatized millions of people. And now his, you know, his company is making, you know, I know it's not him, he's not in charge of it anymore, but it's his legacy that's continuing to capitalize off the people that he hurt. So kind of fascinating.
So he also has a wind up watch, guys. So they, remember they were talking about how they outlawed those batteries? Which I guess is somehow put through by Vite or True or some combination of the conspiracy to keep them out of the hands of normal people. But he does have a very beautiful vintage wind-up watch, in my opinion. So she knows him really well, and she's like, she knows what the hat is. She's like, I see the hat's back on again, kind of needling him for being for his anxiety. And I get the feeling that she still likes him, but she knows that's messed up and she can't deal with it anymore. Because she keeps asking about the women. You know, is this from a woman? But again, I don't think he wants to, and we can talk about this more in a second too, but I don't think he wants that. I think being together with her, though he probably had, you know, feelings for her, was probably harder than being alone in the house.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And that's how it is. But, you know, for a lot of people, when you're dealing with that kind of trauma, I would imagine that that's how it is. I mean, sometimes, you know, I can't speak. I don't know. Sometimes as a person, we all have traumas and stuff, but there's some events in your life. And I think we all have those as well, where you just, if you're confronted with it, or if you're confronted with something that reminds you of it, you know, you pull back, or if in post it happening. Like, I make no secret of the fact that I was homeless, and post that happening, there's definitely a change in something like that changes you. And I think that that's definitely what he deals with. And it's taken me over a decade to get to the point where, like, I can even, you know, stand here and be recording podcasts and writing and doing all that kind of stuff, because it's a profoundly traumatizing thing in my life that's, you know, that completely alters the way you think. What's interesting, and what I want to build off of what Vanessa said, is that they've managed to capitalize on that and make money off of it. And so this is definitely a society that is, it looks like a paradise, but it smells like a, smells like a sewer.
Okay. So the pills.
Yes, you guys were right. You guys were right.
We saw the pills. Right.
The pills of memories. So she's so next episode would be really fun. I mean, we don't have to super talk about it, but the next episode is going to be a trip, literally.
Oh, yeah, literally, like PDPedia. So the PDPedia, so I want to commend the HBO marketing team. I don't know if they outsource it to an agency, but I'm loving the trifold and brochure, like trifold brochures that they have representing, like, you know, the actual, like, the extra-dimensional anxiety thing and the nostalgia pill promotion. I also love the accuracy of how, so I was just like watching a Latuda commercial where they're like, you can be for bipolar depression, and he's like, you can be this and this, but here's all of the side effects, all of this, and if you experience muscle spasms, that could be permanent, sorry. Like, it's like all these, like, and that's like a lot of pharmaceutical commercials are like that. And I thought that was interesting. In the brochure, they were like listing all the side effects, like, oh, you know, night blindness, anal leakage. I'm like, Jesus Christ, like, it's so intense. And I also want to commend their team for putting together something so detailed and so true to the industry, because that's literally what it would be like. Like, that's how it would read. And that's kind of a marketing professional. I'm in the industry, so like, I know wow, like that, it felt like I really was reading, like I was being sold something that was completely fake. And I, by the end of it, I was like, kind of low key want to try this. And they were like, but then I read like the angle leakage thing, and that was like really what stopped me. But I think it's like that, like, I think it's fascinating is that they're like, do not take this whatsoever if it's not your own, which I think is great.
Right, I mean, it's like Harry, not to go Harry Potter on you, but like I'm trying to think of other good examples. Everyone probably knows Harry Potter and the Mirror. It's like
the Pensieve, yeah.
If with my parents, you know, when my parents passed away, it was very much, you know, you get all the recordings out, and you listen to the recordings over and over again, the same, you know, audio clips over and over again, mm-hmm. and you looking in the pictures and you're delving in the pictures, and it's making you sicker and sicker and sicker because you're just going deeper and deeper into this, but you want to touch those neurons. But you want to touch those neurons and get those, that relief, because the panic that it's gone is just intense. But yes, so now we come, so this is where I need to be, is in the support group. So now we come to a church. Now who thought he was there on police business? Anybody?
Honestly, yeah. After I saw everything, I knew that was for him. I had a feeling that was for him. I thought that was, the whole scene was like, was really interesting because everyone just looked so depleted. And that's like the third group therapy scene I've seen in pop culture this year alone. The Boys had one where I hate Billy Butcher, by the way. Hate him. And then on the Boys on Amazon. And then also in Endgame, there was a group therapy scene. And it was, it's interesting how like therapy, mental well-being, mental wellness is getting to the point where people care about it so much. It's permeated our pop culture to this point where it's in our superhero media.
About fucking time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Superheroes need therapy.
Let's not talk about heroes in crisis.
Oh God, no! I didn't even mention it, Tony. I'm getting started.
No, but this was something that didn't happen.
Heroes in Crisis
was not healthy, Carolyn. In case you haven't read it, it was very much not healthy. It was very much the opposite direction and very unfortunate.
Oh, no. I was very warned by a number of people, especially after meeting Tom King at Comic-Con. He was like, oh, we're really, and I mentioned mental health and superheroes, and he was like, oh, we're really, you know, we're really getting into, you know, we're going to get into that, and here's our symbol, and he showed me the symbol for Heroes in Crisis for their little center thing, and I was like, oh, this will be lovely, and then I saw everybody reading it, and then I saw the people talking about Poison Ivy, and then I saw this, and I was like,
I've never seen a single thing, and I haven't even touched it yet, but I don't think I will, but I haven't seen a single thing derided so much by every single person that, like, every single person in the DC fan, like, I follow an array of people, and I literally I don't know if I know a single person that liked that. Anyway, but
You want to talk about positive representation, though. I will give a shout out in brief to Marvel's Unstoppable Wasp, because Jerome Whitley does write mental health extremely well, and he's the first person to write a bipolar character from a positive standpoint. This person was not a villain when they had their bipolar disorder. This person wants to be a hero, has started out heroic, has totally good intentions, and they just happen to be bipolar. And as a bipolar person, when I found that out, I sat there and I cried for 20 minutes in public on a bus, sobbing my eyes out, because positive mental health representation, positive representations of trauma, positive representations of these things can really affect people. And this group session demonstrated in this, to me, brought up several things that I thought they were done very positively. I had to sit and I had to listen. But the whole way that they treated, especially with the gentleman who was talking about intergenerational trauma, that was a learning experience.
So this is something I brought up a couple episodes ago, and I had a feeling they were going to talk about this, because this is something that I think they've been, honestly, they have been teasing. It's something I read an article a while ago, and I hope I can find it, because I would love to link it, about what essentially is, it's framed in an African-American black folks, where our our trauma is inherited. We have generational trauma. It's in our DNA. We carry with us our ancestors. You know, we carry with us, you know, what they went through. And and what I read was specifically about Black women and how we carry trauma just from, you know, misogyny noir between, you know, the cross sections of racism and misogyny, carrying that with us every single generation. I read that and I think that unsettled me for a long time. It was like a few years ago. So seeing a show actually address this and like actually him saying it out loud, it like shook me. Like that was twice in one episode where this episode like took me out of it. I was like, oh shit, I got really emotional. I'm kind of getting emotional right now talking mm-hmm. about it.
So I think one of the things that I also want to point out is this: he's still trying to save people, even though he may not be with his faith anymore. He is in a mm-hmm. church, handing out brochures.
It's his nature. Yeah.
Yeah. He mm-hmm. can't. Yeah. It's the same. It's the same kind of thing. It's the comfort of his youth, you know, that he's going back to.
He's a decent egg, and you know, the fact that he. Immediately as they leave this session, which was
wait, we are not even close to leaving the session. We got to talk about what is going on. So, Friends of Nemo. Okay, so this is what I'm going to come in with a couple of things about Nemo here. So, first of all, understand that Nemo is the Latin word for no man or no one. So it says something about the group. It's like, are you a friend of no one? And, you know, and Wade, like, in fact, kind of, well, also, no, it's more like, you know, are you like me pushing other people away because of your trauma? But Nemo is also the captain from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea of the Nautilus, which is the submarine from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which was a 19th century novel by Jules Verne. The title of the episode is called Little Fear of Lightning. And the quote is, if there were no thunder, men would have little fear of lightning, although the danger is in the lightning, not in the thunder. But I'll read you the whole paragraph because that might give us some even greater context. So they've come to this place that has not been visited by Western man. And the whole book is about colonialism and it was kind of revolutionary in the 1800s for writing a book about kind of like the evils of colonialism. But Nemo's was an Indian prince. As in India, like a Raja's son. And his family had been, and his wife and his children had been killed by colonialists. And his mission was to hunt down the killers and kill them. Of course, once he does it with these, you know, white observers on the ship, but he does it and they take out the ship and then he kind of falls apart and this is important because this is what Wade is on this journey too, where after his reason for being, his whole life's purpose was to take down this guy. Once it's gone, everything falls apart and he spends the rest of the book going mad because he doesn't know what to do now. There's also a giant squid that attacks the submarine, which everyone remembers from the movie and from the ride at Disneyland and Disney World, which Carolyn says now is, what is it, in storage or was it moved to another ride?
So the squid from Finding the octopus from the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea ride is, I believe, in Tivon's fortress because there is an octopus in Tivon's fortress. So it's in Mission Breakout. It's on. It's in a superhero ride.
but it is classic. It is classic. But
it's a classic piece of super. But they did switch over the ride to the Finding Nemo submarine ride, and
which is another Nemo, which probably was based a little bit on Captain Nemo, even in a kind of weird twisted way, but a very different story, more along the lines of Little Nemo, who was a comic strip character from the turn of the 1900s, 1910s maybe, but this so basically they pull the ship into a place where the natives had never seen technology. Like they had some, you know, I'll read you the paragraph, but they were a little encountered civilization, and it says obviously these Papuans had already had encounters with Europeans and were acquainted with their vessels. But this long iron cylinder lying in the bay without masts or funnels was evidently perplexing to them. Clearly, they were somewhat afraid, for up to now, they had kept at a respectful distance. However, seeing it motionless, they began to gain confidence and were now trying to find out more about it. This was exactly what we had to prevent them from doing. Our weapons, which were noiseless, were not likely to have any great effect on these natives, who only respect noisy firearms. If there were no thunder, men would have little fear of lightning, although the danger is in the lightning, not the thunder. And you got to imagine that this is something that Vite probably read and took to heart. Because he doesn't want people poking around at the squid trying to figure out what it is. So he's got to keep the fear going with these rain of squids here. So that is my bit on Nemo. Again, we have, you know, colonialism and technology and all kinds of themes that are running through the rest of the show.
And then he leaves.
Oh, well, sorry. Before he leaves, this is another reference, I think, to the comic where he, like, at the beginning of the support group meeting, he says, "Does it ever end?" And, you know, of course, we want to fill in. No, yeah.
Yes, yes.
But then he says, "Of course it does." And I was like, oh, no. I thought that was cute. I was like, oh.
Where's Dr. Manhattan?
Right. Oh, that does. I don't know why I'm in such a hurry to get out of the support group. I'm sorry, everybody, because everything after the support group is trash. I don't like it.
No, we'll find the deeper meaning.
So he gets out of the support group, and the woman from the support group is still there, and he's listening to her, and she says, you know, she accuses him of still, because one of the other themes they talk about is she accuses him of still being in the tunnel, because he says he's left the tunnel. And he's in the light, because every tunnel has a light. And I actually, hold on, because I actually copied. They did an affirmation at the end.
We know there are other
dimensions than this one. But this is the dimension in which we live, and we will not live in fear. Hello from another dimension. Yay, we're in another dimension.
This reminded me of Gandalf's speech to Frodo about, you know, so he says, "I don't want to live in this time." And he says, "Well, you know, so is the fate of everybody who comes to live in such times. But it's not up to us to choose what time we live in, just what we do with that time."
Yes.
That's a bad summation, but you get it.
But then, so they sit and they're talking, and they're talking about, so they have their affirmation, and he leaves, and they're talking about how he's still in the tunnel. So they go to their, he's talking to her. Anybody else think that Wade is a super smooth talker? Like, he's genuinely good with women.
I think it's implied that he gets a lot of women, but they never stay very long.
Oh yeah, no, but like he was very smooth in that whole interaction. But then they go to the bar, and the only thing I really have to contribute to the bar scene beyond one question that I will ask when we start discussing it is that the song that's playing in the background is "Turtles All the Way Down" by Sturgill Simpson, and he tends to lend his music to really abstract pieces of media. So if you've never seen The Dead Don't Die, which has Adam Driver and Bill Murray and just came out, it's the same sort of avant-garde, you know, living in this reality. Are we in this real reality or are we not? So everybody should listen to Sturgill Simpson. And now we will discuss the bar scene.
That makes sense to me. So this scene, we can go through it in order, but the thing that got to me was Pale Horse.
Yes.
This really changed the mood of the show for me to the point where I don't know if I'm going to enjoy any of the Vite scenes from here on out, just because of this. I didn't have this emotional connection before, and now I do. So instead of making Schindler's List, Steven Spielberg makes a movie about 11-2. And it's called Pale Horse because Pale Horse was one of the people that was playing in that concert the night that it happened. The other one, interestingly enough, that they didn't mention was Kristallnacht. So you've got to wonder if there were some white supremacists in that Top Knots group or in whoever's going to the, like, why on earth would you name your band Kristallnacht? It's Kristallnacht was a massacre pre-World War II.
Yeah, so I don't know if you have to wonder. I think that's pretty, I thought that was implicit, yeah, that they were supremacist, like they were,
yeah,
like
so it is,
they were basically the book's version of what's it, neo-Nazi skinheads, right?
Yeah. And but at any rate, they leave it off of here so that to give you the full impact. But they talk about how if in Schindler's List, I don't know, has everybody watched Schindler's List?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. It's extremely disturbing and extremely powerful and leaves you very shaken. But there was a little girl in it in the red dress. And once you put that image into my head, like I'm like crying and I'm like, I'm now looking at the 3 million people, and that now I wonder if Alan Moore chose that number on purpose to make it more uncomfortable. And I'm like, okay, well now that changes the way I feel about New York. And like, there is no excuse for that, even if you're going to save everybody else on earth. So that did change my emotional viewpoint on the whole thing. Whereas like now it's much more of a tragedy to me. Whereas in the head before it was just kind of a stunt,
like an ethical, you know, question.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's much deeper. So I may change my opinions on a lot of these.
I think that's an interesting kind of like divide, because a lot of people, unless you see the bodies, see the effect, see the impact, the trauma, that the fallout of it, because what we saw when it ended, we were just like, yeah, that makes sense. Like it ended with that, the decision. And then the heroes at the end said, yeah, I guess they were right for the most part. Rorschach disagreed. He died. We were left with, for the last 30 years, with that was okay, yeah, that makes sense, you know, and nuclear war. And now, but now we're seeing the other side of it, so I think, yeah, that also helps with, or also is lending to that discomfort of being okay with it. Originally I don't know if I was ever comfortable with Adrian's method. I was always kind of on the fence about it. I also kind of view him as like a Lex Luthor type sometimes, but the imagery and they hammered it home, but I didn't need that. I the devastation was enough, like him wandering out naked and seeing mostly dead bodies and blood and a couple people wandering, that was and no words being spoken, like that was enough for me. And I know that like the later reference to, like, you know, the Schindler's, it was interesting, and I get that, but I was also uncomfortable with that. And I know it's supposed to be uncomfortable, but I'm uncomfortable with erasing a very, very, very important bit of Jewish history, cinema history.
Yeah, especially if Pale Horse was a skinhead music group.
Right.
But again,
that was more of what I was uncomfortable. I get where they were coming from, but I was uncomfortable with them using, especially since they've been so on point with depicting, you know, being really good at depicting history and retelling the history, and also showing how you know, the consequences of telling history badly, you know, with the whole American Hero Story thing or whatever. Yeah. So I found it interesting, and I'm hoping that I'm confident that it will, because we've seen that so far that everything's pretty much tied together, that they'll come back and address that. Cause I don't know, I felt weird about that.
Well, but Spielberg was in or near New York, or, you know, had, you know, gone on a trip and left New York that day, and maybe his family all died in it. I mean, I think things change what your priorities are. And I think, yes, yeah, still it's bad.
It's what's weird to me is that it came out in 1992, which is only 7 years after the event. I don't remember when the 9/11 movies kind of started.
No, this was Schindler's List. I mean, this was literally supposed to be, instead of Schindler's List, he made the pair.
So like maybe like in the middle of like making the movie.
So it was literally, they picked 92. So that was to get the reaction out of the audience, like, oh.
Yeah, I'm getting, I don't want them to veer into like Legends of Tomorrow territory though. Like, I know it's fun to like, and the show has been really good about framing history in their alternative universe, but there's where you get to just kind of a parody of our own universe. I don't, that felt like that. Yeah, I don't, so that was my only issue. Well, and I haven't had any real issues. Right. Well, yeah, she's also bullshit, but like that was my only issue with that. And I think that's my only issue with the series thus far. And it's pretty rare for me to not have many issues with the show, mostly because I'm just confused at this point. But that was my one little sticking point, was that I wasn't a fan of them erasing Schindler's List, which is a very important movie for that. So we have her, yeah, they're talking about the movie, and then he leaves, right? I'm sorry, I cannot remember.
They get to a point where he hits on her, he flirts with her, and then she flirts back with him, and then she says, "I'm really drunk," and she goes, "You're drunk too." And then she leaves, and when she leaves, he says she's smoking a controlled substance, which is tobacco, mm-hmm. which I find really interesting because they have the police guns are locked, and tobacco is illegal. You have to wonder what else is illegal. And given some things that are said later in the videotape that occur, one of the big liberal talking points and one of the big leftist party talking points, and they say this is a leftist, is, you know, decriminalization of these kinds of things, because the idea is that if you have it readily available, you should be able to use it responsibly. I support decriminalization of all of it. And, you know, restitution made to people who were arrested for it. And so the fact that this is supposedly a liberal paradise where tobacco is illegal is very interesting to me.
But I think that's interesting that you say supposedly liberal paradise, because I'm going to pull out a Marvel reference, because it kind of starting to feel like a little bit of Hydra within the machine a little bit, because I don't know if liberals are
in control at all. I love you, Vanessa. I love you.
Like, I'm starting to get the feeling that, there's just certain things that feel very, I'm not going to lie, Bill. I don't know. I don't want to repeat talking points that I've heard from like crazy right wing people, but like there's some weird shit going on. That's all I'm gonna say.
No, yeah, cause so it's like tobacco is suddenly illegal, and Wade says he can't really call anybody. And when I tweeted it out, I was like, please call Angela, because I missed Angela at this point, and I want her back.
Yeah,
and I was like, please call her, but he didn't.
I don't have any friends.
Yeah,
I don't have any friends.
This is he can't call Angela because they're secret identities. If they're seen together, then people will be more likely to put together that they're
Could be a bro being hired to do market research for her bakery. I mean, police. You made yourself some secret identities. You could get a little more creative with how you interact with them, but that's neither here nor there. So the minute that he gets in the car and he sees her get in the truck, the minute that they get in the truck, I knew that that was the truck from the first episode, and that was the 7th Cavalry truck.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a total unsurprise where he was like, wait a second. And then we see the lettuce, which was a callback. And
they rigged it to go off.
Convenient. I love that they kept, like, the show kept, like, calling back to the lettuce, like, at least a couple more times after we removed all the lettuce. I just remember the damn lettuce.
So I guess you could say they let us in on that clue.
Should we
leave the lettuce alone now?
It was a good one, but no.
Boo.
I've been planting these puns all day, man. That's it.
what I was going to say is I noticed that at this point I was like convinced that she was like 7th Cavalry. So
yeah.
I noticed that, I mean, I can understand it. What kind of rubbed me the wrong way is that they used two, like, seduction scenes to, like, set him mm-hmm. up into a bad situation. And I mean, okay, like, it's kind of, well, they have so many strong, positive female characters that at some point you do earn the right to depict women in a negative way. But it still felt really awkward to me. Like, do they really have to...
Stuck in a loop, though. I think it kind of showed that he was stuck in the loop, but the song they played over and over again, I thought it was kind of out of place, right? Because it was it's a very old song, was Some Enchanted Evening.
That's the theme
over and over.
That's later in the episode because they played it earlier too.
They played it twice. They played it when he was looking at the bunk beds and he was sleeping on the couch.
Okay.
And then they played it at the end of the episode, yeah.
I do think, to Tony's point, though, I think that there making a point of showing his growing distrust, and not just in like the world around him, but in women specifically, because this is the second time that he's been, third time in this episode we've seen that a woman has pulled the wooler's eyes and taken advantage of him. You know, the first scene we see with the girl in the mirror is the Lori bugging him against his, you know, obviously without his consent, you bug, everyone gets bugged without their consent. You don't ask for consent to get bugged. Anyway, and then, you know, this lady, the cavalry lady, doing her, you know, thing. And so this so very smartly sets up why he would, I guess, partially let Angela. Anyway, later on.
Let's get there. Because I think
I think that they were setting up very clearly, telegraphing something, because that's a lot of times where a man is, and it's by a show that's written by women and is directed by women. Like, I think it was purposeful that they were showing that he has a distrust with not just everyone, but specifically with women because of his trauma that was so tied to his, obviously he was probably a virgin at the time, mirrors, the girl betraying him, running off with his clothes, and him coming out, you know, like, I think it's all tied together. And then obviously his wife, who was probably the biggest, the ex-wife was his biggest betrayal. Or not betrayal, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, she left eventually, but I have to believe that was, you know, it wasn't like a sudden betrayal. It was
eventually she did.
Like in 7 years of bad
luck. And I'm Yeah. 7 years of bad luck. I forgot about that.
So I was going to say really quick, because he's in the car and this is before he gets into the mall. It's very interesting that they're in a mall to me too.
Abandoned mall, yeah.
An abandoned mall. Because
so why are malls abandoned if there's no internet?
Because going to the mall is, like, annoying. I literally only go, like, in the
morning. Need the internet for, like, a home delivery service for clothes. Like, you can still do, like, a Stitch Fix type, like, delivery service for clothes without internet. You just call on the phone or watch it on TV. They have, like, a QVC stuff. They still have television. Probably like, order stuff on the internet. But, yeah, that is a good question, that they have burnt out strip malls still in this reality.
But I was going to say, when he's in the car and he's listening, I remembered reading that they did a study that the ticking clock was one of the most unsettling noises. It was such a very subliminal, such a subliminal message. And it's like the two top noises that really stress people out are bees and a ticking clock. And so when he was doing that was a really nice scene. And when he realized that they were like actually 7th Cavalry and he grabbed the gun, and he's got the gun, and it's a real gun, and he just goes in there, and...
I knew something bad was about to happen. I was like, oh, don't go in there. Wait for your backup. Wait for your something.
That was giving me True Detective Season 1 vibes, yo. Like, they're really laying it on thick. Like, him just... Like, everything was... I was like, he's about to find a little girl tied up in the basement. No! Like, it was just very creepy, like... Ugh.
But the reveal was that all of this stuff that you've been taking for granted was, you know, kind of sloppy, and it was all really, really super well thought out, because she has them all looking for a church that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so there's a set of the church, and it's all set up, and it's almost like it was put there specifically for him to find in a certain order. And then the basketballs, which is just playing his dream. So here's my theory about my question for you guys about. So the basketballs start coming randomly out of thin air, and he knows exactly what's going on because this is his paranoia, and he goes and finds it. So, and they continue to test where they put the basketballs into the gate and where they come out. And these are not like your top level scientists. These are pretty, and this is probably, first of all, this is probably how the bomber got to the cemetery. So let's see. I know they were looking in the hole, but I think this is probably what happened. But are they really testing it, or was that simply there to rattle him right before showing him the film?
I think it's on purpose because I think they're testing it on purpose, but I think the testing it at that moment may have been to rattle him, but yeah. I do think they're testing it in general. I suspect that's where all the batteries are going, to this kind of experimental teleportation device and all that. So, but that's my theory.
It could be why the false, he was big on putting out false health scares, right? With Dr. Manhattan. So maybe he put out a false health scare about the batteries, because having the batteries could lead to the gate. But this was, again, the framing story for what happened with the squid was that there was a teleportation technology facility in New York, and that somehow it triggered this creature to come through from another dimension, which was all fake. It didn't actually do anything or have anything to do with it, which we all know, because the squid was fake. But they were blamed for it, and then of course everyone now is afraid of teleportation technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was definitely more scared of by the time when he got in there with the gun drawn, I think that if he had had any intentions of saving anybody, or if he was worried about that, when he found that they were doing portal stuff, like, that became his biggest priority. And I would not have wanted to have been a person who needed saving, because he would have run. Like, he was like, oh, you guys are making portals. And she explains that everything was all set up, which mirrors what happened at the beginning of the episode to me, because, you know, he was set up by a woman the same time, and they rigged the basketball, they rigged the blanks. He was ready to shoot, too. Like, he was full on ready to shoot.
He shot a guy. Yeah, he didn't have any bullets in the gun.
Mm-hmm. He just didn't have any bullets in the gun. He was really ready to do this, and then they knocked him out, and they take him to this room, and the Veidt vibes, the Adrian Veidt vibes in this room were real.
It is the wall of TVs, yeah, directly from that scene, and we can post panels of that from the comic.
So he's got these TVs. Tony, yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, the first thing he says in that scene, I believe, is, "You're going to kill me."
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that.
And he might have been right.
Well.
Like, honestly, like, take something, like, something that you have held as your life perspective. You've built your entire life around, your personality around, your one personality trait, your lifestyle, everything you do, how you eat, how you function is built around a fucking lie. Yeah. If someone tells you that is a lie, yeah. There's other ways to be killed, and besides just the body, that could kill a person, or it could wake them up. But I'm leaning more towards he died.
He definitely did not seem to be the same person after this, because he's sitting down and he looks at the person who came in, and it turns out to be Keen.
Yes,
not Senator great Keen.
And so we find out that Senator Keen is the leader of the 7th Cavalry. And I want to point out that James Wolk, Wolk is my maiden name, and his father has the same name as my father, which I've mentioned on the show before, but he's Jewish. So here you have a Jewish actor playing, and we knew from PDpedia that his dad was in the Klan, or his grandpa was in the Klan, I don't know. But it still was very jarring to see him as, you know, kind of the head of the, and of course he's obviously, you know, indicating that he's using them, and he does not want to hang out with the white supremacists any more than he has to. Yeah, he says, "I came down here and assumed leadership of these idiots to prevent that shit from happening again." So he's acting like, you know, "Oh, I'm just leading them to control them to make sure they don't do anything worse." But what they've been doing lately isn't so great either. So,
Yeah, I would say, like, if you're working with or controlling them, regardless, you instantly become one of them.
Yeah.
He may not believe in what they believe, but I'm pretty sure he doesn't give a shit about anybody but himself.
Yeah. I would say he has his own brand of white supremacy. Like, supremacy looks like theirs.
We have the squid pro quo references.
Oh my.
Yeah. Which is a bit on the nose coming this week.
But he's in this for power, though, because he also says, before he shows him the tape, he says, "I got on the appropriations committee, but I wanted something sexy like intelligence." And I'm like, Dude, the Appropriations Committee is very sexy. You get to look at everybody's tax returns. I mean, you're basically handling all of the money, but the fact that he just seems very juvenile and very childish, and like he's definitely being used and definitely just a terrible being, but
he's part of the legacy, just like Judd was.
True. And he confirms that Judd was also doing his part to kind of control everything. Mm-hmm. We knew it, but like he makes it like official, like officially official, like mm-hmm. there's no doubting whatsoever. We knew it. It's just, you know, I don't know. Anyway, he comes in and he has the tape. And I have a question about this tape.
CD.
CD.
What's the question?
Get you like MP3 files, like Watchmen World, get you some digital.
They don't have cell phones.
How did he know? Did they mention time travel at all?
No, it's not time travel. He planned it. He was very clear. Is that like it was all about he planned it? So there's a couple of layers here. One, is that really Adrian Veidt, or is it people that wanted the Rorschach to have proof for Rorschach constructed it? Because it was very odd. And why would you make it 7 years early and then send it 7 years later? But regardless, it then has two more hours that we don't get to see, but he saw. So what did he see in those two? Did he see the rest of the plot of the show in those 2 hours? I don't know why he would do this. Why would Adrian do this?
Yeah, that didn't make sense to me. I thought it was fake, though, because, I mean, we know it's the truth, but I did think if they hadn't mentioned that it was 2 hours long, I think I'd been like, why would you believe this thing? It could be edited. It could be actor. It could be, like, that isn't... Who would believe this? Especially someone who's like so into the trauma. Like, I know, like, just because there's things that I believe that are irrational, and like you can tell me, okay, well, that banana is not going to hurt you if you eat it, and I know that banana's going to hurt me if I eat it, but I'm not going to eat the banana because it has like gross strings on it. Yeah. So if he's so wrapped up in his, I don't want this to happen. Like he's so wrapped up in like protecting himself from another attack. I'm not even sure if a 2 hour long video should really change his mind or anything, but I don't know.
There's more to it than that. Like there's more to even start. So before we, like, I know we already jumped into it, but there's more to the quid pro quo than that. He very explicitly says, you know, you're gonna do this for me. I'm doing you a favor. You're going to do me a favor. Because if you don't, I'm going to tell him you're crazy, and then I'm going to go to Angela's house and kill her kids.
Ooh, that's tough.
And that, I think, to me, is like that. I think it's really easy to miss that in all of the other stuff.
Yeah.
But when he tells her he had no choice, that's the only place in here where I could see where he had no choice. Because he didn't give him an ultimatum based on the video, unless there's something else in the video that we didn't see, that's totally possible. But the ultimatum is like, you're going to tell me or I'm going to kill her and her whole family. And I think on some part of him, he wanted to turn her in to protect her and her family.
I just don't know. I don't know if I've seen enough and I think that's the point. I think the show purposely obscures it. I don't know if I've seen enough where I think that he cares enough that he would protect her and her kids. He literally mocked her about her kids. Your kids. I didn't forget that. Like, and I know she didn't forget that. They have a very contentious relationship. And so I could see where he might be protecting her, but I also don't, I have not seen a single shred of evidence in the show so far where that he cares about her or her family.
But you could say, I had to. I'm sorry. I had to. Yeah. So that is there. And on some level, it's like, I feel like he needed to hear the truth. Like, he knew she was lying. We know because of all this other stuff that he knew she was lying. And she wouldn't tell him. That was driving him nuts as well. Because, you know, you're also learning that Jed wasn't the guy who you thought he was. So I don't know. But at any rate, so he watches this entire movie. And then we cut to our Veidt segment of the week.
Before we get to it, I do want to mention that Keen specifically mentions needing Angela out of the way for a couple of days, which yes. coincides with the mm-hmm. truth and Will plan of 3 days. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing they're not on the same side, but whatever is going down is about to, really about to go down.
I have a feeling the bat, like, so wild theory time. I don't know if anyone's mentioned this or if this is implied, but like the melting of the battery, the picking of the, I don't know if they're melting. I might just pull that out, but the collecting of the battery, watch batteries, as a, and then the whole cancer causing thing, they're thinking, oh, ha, cancer bomb. Could that be a potential thing to take down the new watchtower? Watch bomb, ooh. Watch millennium tower, whatever. I have a feeling that we're getting all these things. I'm thinking, obviously they're planning a terrorist attack. You think they're blowing up the tower?
That's an interesting theory, especially since the tower, I think, has another meaning. I still yes. think the tower has something deeper going on. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, for sure. But it's not just a clock.
Well, so no. look at the symbol. So if you remember the symbol from the letterhead that Elder Keen sent to Judd's father, grandfather, whatever, that, and then you remember the look, what the symbol is on the clock, and you remember the symbol on the Ferris wheel earlier, and remember now the symbol is painted on the door of the mall.
Yeah,
they're all kind of the yeah. guys. And you remember even the camera lens in the satellite. It is kind of this kind of eye image.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not ready to write off the fact that somehow the plots are all connected and that there aren't two sides.
Oh no, I wasn't saying. Wait, you think there or there's only one side? I'm confused.
It's possible that he's doing. He may not be working for Lady True, but he may be doing exactly what Lady True wants him to do.
Okay. I guess the only thing I'm convinced they're not working together mainly because
oh yeah I don't think they're working
Will
together.
Be doing like why would he be trying to catch Will if he knows Will is involved with True like that at that point
is
that,
he trying to catch Will or is he just trying to maybe to
why does he want Angela out of the way like why would Angela matter
she keeps investigating I think whatever she's investigating something he doesn't want to investigate that she doesn't even know she's investigating is what I'm assuming. It's a classic detective yeah. tale where, like they're looking for something else and they stumble upon the truth. And, like, I feel like she's whatever she's searching for, whatever answer she's trying to search for, basically the Judd thing, she's going to, he wants her off the Judd thing. I'm essential. I think that's basically what it is.
Yeah, that's what I think. I definitely think it's not like, is he, whatever he's doing is not, like, he might be, like, being chess moved by True, but he's not directly working.
No, yeah, no, I wasn't saying he was. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a, but it's still, I think it's part of the plan, as you can see. Like, some of that stuff is way too clever for him, but yeah.
I have to also wonder.
Some of the stuff does predate Lady True, though, between the generations. Like,
yeah, that's why I have to wonder if, with what happens in the Vite segment that comes after this, if Manhattan is playing around. And I have a theory, I have a reason for this, okay, hear me out. So, the Vite segment happens, and we learn, essentially, we're going to break this down, but we learn, essentially, that there is a god that made the place that Vite is, and it is a him. It is definitively known as a him, and there's only one male being, one god, one who is, you know, who has that ability. So, it's Manhattan, okay?
Are you jumping ahead, Carolyn?
Well, she,
all right. Oh, so
my point is that this god has abandoned them, and the god, and they're using the all-seeing eyes, okay? And they've got all the eyes, and the eyes are everywhere. I think that True and Vite set up something, and Manhattan is either trying to stop it or trying to do something different with it. And apart from all of the eyes that are watching people, because True's symbol is not eyes. True's symbol is, you know, the different things. But apart from all the symbols of all the eyes watching people, all connected to that storyline, True's symbol is something completely different. And I think we're going to find out what that is next week. But now we have
They actually showed in one of the PDpedia add things, yeah. Like, because the nostalgia was something her company made. So yeah. Her symbol is like a pointy, like, T thing.
Okay. So you have a different symbol, but the eyes are something completely different. I think what it is True and Veidt set up something, and Manhattan is trying to stop it. And so Manhattan, and the only other thing that I have that kind of proves my theory a little bit is the scene that they were showing in the trailer that everybody was freaking out about, where the world's, there are all the papers and everything's blown around, mm-hmm. and there's a scene of devastation, and the blue hand comes down and picks mm-hmm. shit up. So whatever it is, Manhattan's going to be there at ground zero when stuff goes down. But now we have to go through the Veidt segment so everybody will understand what I'm talking about, because I want to talk about Iron Man in space.
Oh, goodness. I have one thing to say, but it's towards the end, and it's just that there's a word that we don't get to see all of in the message that he sets. And we don't know what it's... So it's like, it says, save me. And then D, maybe?
Yes. That's what
save me, daddy.
Are you appropriating daddy?
But the other thing I wanted to point out is that he's
probably... Is it Veidt Manhattan for...
Daddy Manhattan.
You're so daddy. So anyways, I personally think that Manhattan is gone. And maybe it'll be an ironic twist at the end. I think he's gone. But
I know. I'm leaning that way too. Yeah.
And I want to point out that Jupiter, Sally Jupiter connection. It's not Mars. He's orbiting. He's Jupiter. On Io orbiting Jupiter.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Of course. First Hill Spectre's last name, show name was Jupiter.
Mm-hmm. But he's been launching, so we discover that he's in an alternate dimension. The short roundup for Veidt is we discover...
I don't know.
In an alternate dimension?
It honestly felt like he was in a dome, right?
He's in a biodome.
Yeah, he's in a space dome. Something, yeah. He was in something that allowed him to breathe and inhabit whatever planet he's on.
Yeah.
Or
anybody getting it?
Wait, he's on another planet, right? I'm not crazy.
I think he's on Io. I think he's on the moon Io, the moon of Jupiter, because it's the most likely.
They didn't confirm though that he was on another planet. Like, it didn't like do that whole like pan away where it's like
they Jupiter would was in the background.
Okay, that's what I figured.
Yeah, that was Jupiter.
You guys,
I knew I remember something.
What if he's on Europa? 2001. 2001 A Space Odyssey?
No, that was Io. That was Io.
It was attempted. Was it Io or was it Europa? Because the alien message at the end of 2001 was attempt no landing on Europa, because David Bowman had gone there to make life. And so he was doing stuff with the life on there. And then they turned Jupiter into a second sun, so he became a binary star system. But that has neither. That's
right, so we'll put it down, guys. Here's the bet. We'll see who's right on Twitter.
Don't check it out now.
I know who's right.
Okay, is it Europa or is it Io? Everybody vote Team Europa. Because, but that's also another allegory is that, you know, in 2001, Bowman gained godlike power, and ultimately abandoned Earth completely, and went to Io or Europa and made life. And he's been doing this with Veidt, and the clones / beings that have no other purpose but to serve, and even the representative of the Game Warden know that they are created by a god. Mm-hmm. And that god,
sorry. Nope. I would say the Warden, I think, is just, it's Tom Meissen.
It's Tom Meissen, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I watched too much Sleepy Hollow. I know that voice anywhere.
No, and it's also his face. Yeah, it literally, it's Tom Meissen.
So it is
the Game Warden. It's just not a clone. Another servant, as you will.
But he's, so, okay, but if we go through the God theory, has Manhattan made other super beings, or other beings like that? Are they like?
I would bet, yeah.
Are they like his angels that kind of supervise these little projects here? Because we were talking a while back, about the biblical references of this. And so I wouldn't be surprised if Veidt was in some sort of Garden of Eden, and then you have this angel who's supposed to be keeping people out, and he's like, oh, God has abandoned us. And obviously their God abandoned them either to go back to Earth to fix things, or he went over to Doomsday Clock. So who wants to be right here? Okay, everybody wants me to be right. You guys don't want to be Doomsday
Clock. I think that it's an interesting thing that he's trying to, you know, he's leaving the Garden of Eden, eating the apple and leaving the garden. I think that's an interesting, there's a lot of biblical references, a lot of biblical allegories in this story, or in this, in the show. I am leaning more and more every episode, leaning towards the dramatic twist slash irony that this show is focusing and talking a lot about Manhattan. I don't think he did spare, they very specifically said at the end of the original graphic novel that he said he was leaving this galaxy for another one, this galaxy, not this planet. So I don't think I think he left and he hasn't been back. So I am starting to lean that way. I was like, really, because he's my favorite and I really, really, really want to see him in live action, but I'm starting to lean that he's not. And if whatever version we do see of him may not be him.
So
yeah, like I'm wondering if it's a Keen thing now or a True thing.
It's a watchmaker thing, right? So I obviously Dr. Manhattan is the only one capable of putting him in on whatever moon or Jupiter is.
Right.
But at the same time, he's the watchmaker, and of course the watchmaker theory of God is that he set the watch and left it to run, which seems to be, and you know, we know that Dr. Manhattan is a watchmaker, and it seems to be what has happened with this group. And it is possible that Veidt is there to be the devil, to tempt them with knowledge.
I can't believe you guys are standing behind the Dr. Manhattan is in Doomsday Clock theory, because
I haven't read Doomsday Clock, so I don't know. Yeah. I'm just thinking based on the show and like what I read, but like I really don't know if he stuck around. Like I don't know if he ever cared enough about us. But on the other hand, like yes, I don't know who else could put Adrian Veidt on another planet. Like,
he's not really a good guy. In that. Yeah, if you're following.
Yeah, I know. I've heard some things. Yeah, I've heard some things. But yeah, I do find it interesting though. Like you said, the watchmaker theory of God, like you know, kind of set a clock and left it running. I've always taken the view of God as he gave us free will and he's letting us have that. That's our thing. The ultimate gift and curse was free will. Everything from that decision was based on is our decision. Everything that has come based on that. So I find it interesting. If Manhattan is still in the show and he's still around and he's playing God, he's specifically creating beings without freedom, without free will.
Why didn't he give them free will?
Exactly, which I think is the opposite of God, because God gave us. I mean, at the very end, you can believe it or not or whatever, you can say whatever you want, but at the end of the day, he gave us free will. So like,
there's
and Manhattan, if it, yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say you're absolutely right, but you made me think of a line from a comedian of a comedy bit that you just reminded me of, where they're talking about Adam and God in the Garden of Eden, and the comedian goes, mm-hmm. "Once upon a time, you know, Adam was like, hey, I'm going to eat this apple. Once upon a time, God was like, hey, don't eat the apple. And then Adam eats the apple, and God says, why would you do that kind of thing? You know, but and Adam says, well, now I have absolute power just like you do. And then God says, yeah, but you know everything. Now you know how to die. And Adam says, well, why would, you know, but still, you said I wanted absolute power. Absolute power is what I want. That's your job. And God says, yeah, my job sucks. So, that made me think of that because, mm-hmm. you know, Manhattan started out as a human. And yeah. Human beings with our free will oftentimes choose to be empathetic to the point that it gets dangerous. And we've seen Laurie asking Manhattan to not come back, but trying to reach him. Mm-hmm. And while I think it would be a really great twist to not have him be involved at all, it goes against the idea that, like, you know, that they seem to be setting up that there's some sort of humanity to be found, either to be found in either giving up absolute power or into even having absolute power. Because if you think about it, if you straight up think about Manhattan, he could theoretically, with his own power, wish his own power away if he wanted to. because he can
I don't think it works like that. I don't, you can't, it, he doesn't wish, he could destroy himself.
Yeah, he's not, it's not himself, magic. But,
I mean, wish is a poor term. He could
can't
destroy,
become human. He's tried. He tried to become human. He couldn't.
Really? Okay. Well, that shakes that theory, but still, that they're toying with the idea of absolute power being human.
I'm going to make you feel better. You were right about Europa. That last speech is, all of these are yours, which I think they were all livable, but all these are yours, save Europa. So I've been denerded today.
2001 just scared the crap out of me as a kid. So, but yeah, so I don't know.
I just realized another reference. I was thinking about the eye, you know, on our dollar bills. There's the eye over the pyramid, the new wonder of the new world. That's what this tower is supposed to be. And yeah, and then also the watchtower. It's a watchtower.
Yes.
Literally a watchtower. It's literally building a watchtower. It makes a lot more sense now that they tied in that piece of Jehovah's Witness, I guess, culture. Because I was like, besides just like the fact that it's super religious, I just wasn't sure why they chose to use that, but now it makes perfect sense. Now I'm just like connecting it. Anyway, I've connected the dots. Anyway.
Okay, regarding Manhattan, sorry, I do want to point out that I don't think he's all powerful. I think his power is atomic based, kind of. So he can mess around with reality because all reality is atoms. But that's different from like actually being able to, like, that's more of a transformative thing than a, like it's different than being a god. Like, so he might be able to like create life, like he can, okay, I can make this DNA and stuff like that, but
he can't put souls like, in the bodies.
Yeah, like he can't like actually like create. So I think we need to, or at least, I mean, my perspective is, I don't think he's all powerful. I think we need to maybe like just kind of consider, okay, just because he can like see all of time and stuff like that, but that's, these are like,
he's more omniscient, right? He's more omniscient than he is omnipotent. Like, okay. He's not, he can't do everything. He could, but he knows everything for the most part.
Yeah, like what he's doing is like tachyons and like electrons and stuff. He's not magic. He's not like Zatanna making
right. But he's got like prediction on the level of like a dream girl, right? So like if you go by Doomsday Clock, which, no, we don't go by Doomsday Clock, he and also in Watchmen, he knows something's going to happen in the future, but you know, it's sometimes that blank vision can be blank, especially if it involves him or the destruction of the universe. He can't necessarily see it. So yeah, he's not even,
and this also ties in with, yeah, well, and that's the thing, he's more omniscient than he is omnipotent is what I'm saying. I'm not saying he's omniscient completely, but yeah, I think he just knows more than he can do, physically do, but obviously he can do more than us. But I want to say this also ties in, I know Carolyn mentioned a while ago, tying in Crisis on Infinite Earth and Watchmen came out within, I think, a year of each other, within a few months or whatever.
Yeah.
I think they're both in the 85. And they're both having their live action moments this year, one on CW, one on HBO. They're also, to Wendy's point, when tachyons get involved, Manhattan can't see the future as well. Barry, in an episode of Flash, Barry had an episode where he couldn't see the future. He couldn't see because of a wall of antimatter. So this also kind of plays into these all powerful characters that can play with time and literally travel dimensions and do these things, but they are stopped by certain things that made them, essentially, which I find fascinating. Anyway, science.
You guys just pointed out something really interesting to me. It literally just rushed out of my head. No. Okay. Manhattan sees the future but can't do anything about it. Vite creates his own future.
Yeah.
And then Looking Glass, a normal man, a seemingly totally normal man, is aware that both of these things suddenly happened, and he has no reason necessarily. Whatever he saw on that 2-hour tape convinced him that if Keen wasn't 100% right, then there was something fishy going on. So whatever he saw, that convinced him, and that's we go back into the precinct, and he's living with this. And Angela comes up, and Angela finally reveals, not finally, she reveals what she's been working on.
He makes and it's her.
It's a rare moment of trust, and he spits on it, and that hurts.
Never trust white men. Except for my husband, because he's awesome. Anyway.
But you gotta, like, they knew about the wheelchair, she was hiding all this, and she was hiding her grandfather. That's not... Angela probably should have come clean about this a little bit earlier. I know it maybe wouldn't work for the plot of the show, but, like, in reality...
I assume he, like, took her car. It should have been, like...
Yeah.
I don't know how he even kept that a secret. Like... I think that was a bit of a stretch of what whatever it is. I don't know what that term is called.
Suspension,
but, like,
of disbelief.
Yeah, like, I was like, wait a minute. How did her whole ass car disappear and not a single person realize until it landed in front of Lori, like, a day later or whatever?
She
I was
walked
like,
fast.
Like, what? Right? And I was like, I know she has another car, but I know she's been driving her kids around in that thing. Like, come on. So I just, yeah, there's that was, I do, I appreciate Regina King's acting in the scene a lot. Her face really, really showed the betrayal and the, and then when she takes those pills, that last minute desperation of just like, fuck it. Was there something communicated? Like, I just feel like I missed a scene where they secretly communicated that she should do that so that he could help her out later, but maybe that's just me being hopeful that Wade's gonna help her out later. And then he,
but well,
he
I think it's more complicated. Than that. I think it's more
if he survives,
yeah. So this theory's on that. Is it, are we there yet, or are we still in the precinct?
We're still in the precinct because she's yelling at him why after she takes the nostalgia pills, but everybody's panicking about her taking the nostalgia pills, which makes me wonder what's happened to other people who have taken those pills.
Petey, it's help.
Can imagine.
Well, no, I guess it's help us, but it warns us about the effect.
And a leakage.
Yeah. That's about even just taking your own. That's side effects of just taking your own. But, like, there's, like, side effects to taking someone else's. Nostalgia can literally, they say something called loss of identity. Like, you can literally lose your sense of self, who you are as a person. It completely is a result in a complete mental psychotic break, as well as just being completely disoriented and all this other stuff. So we're gonna see some wild shit next episode. I can already.
Yeah, it's gonna be like a masterclass of acting kind of thing.
Yes, this is an Emmy worthy.
Yeah, I want Regina King to take away some award buzz for this because she's really bringing it, and it's she's really really bringing it, and the. But she's taking it. This also puts together a very interesting. Nostalgia was made by True and Veidt, or was she, because if that's the case, then True is drugging her own daughter potentially with someone else's nostalgia.
Because
there's no reason.
I'm assuming it's her own or her mother's. It's probably her mom's.
That's what. Oh my god, what if you're drugging other people with nostalgia so that you could clone yourself and then you could live forever?
I do think that's what's going on here.
I think you're right, yeah. I think that's how people live forever. Or they're gonna try to live forever.
That's a scary fucking thought, though, for Angela and for Regina King, because if she took his pills and she loses her sense of identity...
And he becomes her.
He becomes her. That's messed up. I got chills.
Yeah. They're basically, what if they're literally creating extensions of them? They're just creating extensions of themselves, new bodies for once after they pass
but
and after they die.
He would just clone himself.
Like, but he's it's not him. A clone is of you, is not you.
He's going to become him. I don't think you transfer your consciousness. I think what they're talking about here is like, preserving a legacy. It's about legacy, not necessarily about you living, but someone with all of your memories because you think you're so perfect.
Just say that
the world needs you.
Right. It's not the same as cloning yourself because there is no legacy when you clone yourself because they're just essentially
your sister.
Just you. Yeah.
That's just okay, but that's just it. If I clone Carolyn right now, okay, and Carolyn grows up and Carolyn has a feed, Carolyn's a baby, Carolyn's this, Carolyn's that. By default, the Carolyn that I clone is going to have different experiences than me. Unless I transfer my sense of self to this other Carolyn, either via my memories or something else, there's no reason that this Carolyn is going to have the same issues that I do. Yes, there would be some physical issues, but there's the mental stuff, but that does make a very interesting and compelling point to talking about generational trauma. So we're exploring that as well, because, you know, does the stuff that Angela went through, or the stuff that her grandfather went through, is that going to pass on to Angela? We already know it kind of does.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And then, you know, she takes the nostalgia. So is she going to become an extension of herself? Are we breeding bloodlines here? Like, what's happening? It's absolutely wild. And next week's episode is only, I really hope that as cool as it's going to be, it's going to provide some more answers. Yeah. But this show is just incredible.
Cal being awesome again, right? Although that, my guess is that that might be revealed too. But
oh, wait, on Calvin, in the preview, the caption for the preview mentioned his last name is Avar. So yeah. I went and like Googled to try to find like places where like it's common for the men to take the women's name, and I couldn't really find anything. I know in like French Canada the women usually keep their own name, that kind of thing, but
I have so to assume he's leaving something behind. It could be that like
do we know whose name is Avar?
It's her name, because it's her dad. When we went through the family tree, they named her dad or her mom. Dad is Avar.
So I had some Angela talking about Angela Avar, and not to completely derail this, I did have a listener write in this week, and hold on, let me pull up the name. It was Rick G, to talk about the kind of Exodus mentions on the show, and there's a lot of talk about, you know, legacy, and that can relate to the firstborn. And, you know, of course, we have Squid's Fall, which is very much like, one of the plagues of Exodus. Mm-hmm. But we also have Angela's name. So Abar is the name for to pass over. In Hebrew, it means similar to pass over. It's not Pesach, but it's Abar means, you know, to pass over. And our first name, of course, is Angela. So in, you know, Exodus, it is the angel of death that went to houses, and if they were not marked, the firstborn child was killed as the last plague. And that, to me, that's kind of sent chills down my spine. It's like, is there something going on here? Like, we're looking at, you know, families. Are they going to take the firstborn of every family or something along those lines? There's going to be a human sacrifice. And is that what's going on with the... With the 7th Cavalry or what Lady True is doing, because it does feel, I think we're all getting that kind of like,
something
there's
bad.
Probably going to be some death.
As someone who's watched previous Damon Lindelof shows, like I'm having, he does apocalyptic like Armageddon type events very well in that, to show the devastation and impact of like an entire like what a single event can happen on an entire populace. So I can see something as wild as like the tower just wiping half of the world's population out of existence, or moving them to another dimension completely, or off planning them. Like it's within his writing abilities, and something that I've seen him do. And the reason why Leftovers is such a good show is because they explored the concept of what would happen to the society if 2% of the world's population disappeared inexplicably? How would that impact everyone else going forward? So I just have this like dread in my chest that it obviously isn't going to be the same exact thing, but there's something that's going to happen that's going to affect the entire population. And I'm dreading it.
I am a little scared about that. But the other thing to remember about, and I don't know how this fits all into it, but Ozymandias was another name for Ramses II. Mm-hmm. No, Ramses III was the pharaoh of Exodus, but it is another Ramses pharaoh connection. And remember, Moses is Superman is a Moses allegory. Like, we keep talking about there's these multiple Superman allegories. Maybe what we're missing is we're seeing it as Superman, but underneath the Superman is Moses.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to also point out that Moses, there is a story of Hebrews leaving, oppressive regime. And the Moses allegories, I would like to say that, Superman was created by Jews. And I think that's great. And I think I love that the tying of history together of the Exodus and the deeply rooted history that Jewish people have in our culture, that they literally in every story, it's almost impossible to tell a story without some traumatizing or shitty thing happening to them throughout history. And the Moses and the Exodus story is one of them, the parting of the Red Sea and all that. If people don't know that, that's, you reference your local Bible for that.
What if Lady True is trying to create the Angel of Death? Because she gives the memories to, he gives her memories to give to Angela, and Angela gets the memories. So Angela has a reason. Angela has all these memories of this person who, I think we could all agree at this point that Grandpa Will is Hood of Justice. She has all the memories of Hood of Justice. So, she has her own skills. What if she's trying to create an Angel of Death to do her will or to do someone's will?
But there's irony in that, like, her avatar is Lady True and Adrian's is Ozymandias and Angela's is the Angel of Death.
Yeah, I mean, like, what if Angela is going to be used in some fashion by this?
I don't know because of something Lady True said herself was that she thought that the pills were just a silly bit of exposition, was a passive aggressive form of exposition. I don't think she was really a fan of that whole approach anyway, of him just giving her the pills instead of just directly saying to Angela like what was going on. So I don't know what's happening if Lady True really cares about Angela outside of Will caring about her.
I don't have answers, so just gonna let it hang there. I think it's important that it's like there so that if more threads come up you can tie them.
Okay, well I think we did this episode.
So wait, the last thing is so here's a theory in my house is what's gonna happen to Wade, right? Is he just not so is it without thunder men have little fear of lightning and the lightning's coming to his house but he stopped listening because there's no more thunder and he doesn't know that they're coming and they take him unaware, or do we think he's gonna have the house rigged Home Alone style because he's paranoid?
I mean it could be anything. Like I almost think like if this was like okay like a CW show or something where you know the characters are sticking around, I would say he talked to Lori off screen and she helped him through some of the trauma. Like it could be anything really, but I do think he's just dead though. I think
I don't know if it's as simple as him being dead physically, but I keep getting True Detective vibes from him, and I just there's been an episode, I think it was a season 3 one where these white supremacists came after this dude and it was a Native American man who they thought was had killed these kids or kidnapped these kids, and he booby trapped his house and like boom, just like explosions and things and all that. So I'm honestly thinking that's how he dies. They storm his house but he takes out most of them with him. I mean, he might die or he might escape. I don't know. But I'm thinking more that he's laying a trap for them. That he knows that they're not going to, he literally said, you're going to kill me. Like they expose a huge secret to him. I don't think he's stupid enough to think they're actually going to leave him alive.
No, absolutely not. Wade has become such a fascinating character. Like my God. We did this episode, guys.
Shall I check us out?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. If you would like to contact Watchmen Podcast, you can email us at Watchmen watchmanpodcast@gmail.com. You can post a comment on our website, watchmanpodcast.com. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can call us at 918-200-9103. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Watchmen Podcast. On Twitter, you can follow us at Watchmen Talk. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher Radio. We always love it when you give us a rating and leave us a review. Watchmen Podcast is part of the DC TV Podcast Network. So if you're interested in other DC TV shows, you can check out the Batwoman Podcast, the Black Lightning Podcast, DC TV Classics, DC's Legends of Tomorrow Podcast, iZombie Radio, Krypton Podcast, Stargirl Podcast, Supergirl Radio, Swamp Thing Radio, The Flash Podcast. You can subscribe to DC TV Podcast on Apple Podcasts and follow DC TV Podcast on Twitter and like DC TV Podcast on Facebook. Until next time, tick tock, tick tock.